you know, the basics of socialism, like we were talking about earlier, and they probably do conflate reformist and liberal ideas in with socialist ideas. But 51% is a lot of people. So I'm going to say also that a lot of people, and the operative phrase is a lot, meaning millions, might have a pretty good idea what socialism is. And because capitalism isn't cutting it, or because they've decided to look into socialism. I mean, there was this year not that long ago where the most, it was in the, I'd say within the last 5 years, there was a year where the word socialism was the most looked up word that year on, you know, on online. And anyway, I would not deprive people of their legitimate ability to understand and articulate what socialism is. However, because of what we talked about earlier with the conflation of a lot of non-socialist ideas with socialism in a way to sort of usurp anything to the left of liberalism or anything to the left of the Democratic Party and kind of make it all seem like one giant mess and therefore never get to the really left-wing discussions or left-wing ideas, then I'm a little worried about that. But, you know, that's interesting. 51%. Now, in comparison, right, 2016, it actually went down a little bit, from 55% to 51%. But also that positive view of capitalism went down. So that, a lot. It went down over 12 points. So you figure if people are more critical of capitalism, they might just discover something about socialism. Now, in the United States, again, because of that lack of a workers' party of some sort, a socialist, communist, labor party, unfortunately for millions and millions of people, myself included in an earlier generation or whatever, it's rather accidental how you come across socialist ideas. I mean, I grew up thoroughly worked on and brainwashed to a certain extent in Cold War propaganda, right? And it was crude. It was not like this socialism is okay, that socialism is not okay, that kind of socialism is not okay. It was all lumped together. Everything was communist. Martin Luther King was a communist to a lot of people when he was active, before he was assassinated, before he was murdered. I mean, anything sort of bad was lumped in as commie or communist during the Cold War. And yet, despite that, I dug my way out of that. I think, like a lot of other people, some things were rather accidental. Some things made sense given what I was experiencing in life. Because again, you know, you can have a carefully crafted propaganda system, like in the United States. You can read about you can do research on actual scholarly and scholarly works published in journals and in more popular publications by the CIA consistently in order to, in the past, I'm not sure when they stopped doing this, if they even did stop it, but, you know, you can look at COINTELPRO, you can look at all these things that, are used to, create a world propaganda view, but and channel that through the education system, channel that into through the corporate media and so on. I mean, money, you know, as Marx talked about, there's a famous quote by Marx, the ruling ideas of any age are the ideas of the ruling class, meaning that if you have a capitalist ruling class at a given moment in history, then you're going to have pro-capitalist ideas are going to be the most popular, so to speak, or the most produced ideas out there, you know, in terms of propaganda, in terms of educational materials, and so on and so forth. So that is a big hurdle to overcome. So, for example, when I was growing up, it didn't even occur to me to look for a book about socialism when I was in high school or junior high. But, you know, they give you some stuff to read that's got a theme of adolescent rebellion in it or something. And they think they're careful about it, but one thing might lead to another. And so I, you know, just kind of started to read about anarchism. And first right-wing anarchism, unfortunately, and then left-wing anarchism. And still didn't quite do it for me. Still a lot of, you know, things that didn't make sense. Even though I understood the arguments, the concepts, it didn't make sense in terms of what political organizing I was starting to do, what my, you know, work I was starting to do. I was doing factory work in upstate New York and so on. So then before going to college, and then, you know, ironically, we're just playing the Clash here. Reading about the Clash and listening to the Clash's music really introduced me to a lot of just sort of names and concepts about socialism that hadn't been clearly presented to me for some reason. Now, I know that there are people that go to high school and they get some sort of social introduction to socialist ideas in high school from a teacher that's trying to, you know, show them what these ideas are, even if they don't believe in them or something. I never got that. That was kind of a risky thing to do when I was growing up. And I knew people where that had happened, but I knew a lot of people where that didn't happen. And I was one of those where there was never any attempt to explain anything about socialism to me. And in the high school library, and how many high schools still have libraries? Not that many, but in the high school library that we had, it was easier to find anarchist books than socialist books. And I was finding the anarchist books and reading them. And it wasn't until I ran into the Clash just before I went to college. And then in college, took my philosophy course, core curriculum course I had to take, where they one of the first readings was the Communist Manifesto. And the professor was, you know, careful to try and trash the Communist Manifesto after he had assigned it. But I was blown away by it. It said a lot to me. And no matter how much he tried to, you know, walk it back, as they say these days, it was too late. It spoke to me as a worker, as a working class person. It brought up stuff that I kind of vaguely thought I knew, didn't really know, but it you know, thought I did. The summer after I ran into that and I was back working in a factory again in upstate New York, I read volume one of Capital. I just got it out and I read that sucker. Thought I understood it all. Didn't understand it all. Understood a lot of it though. And if you want to, by the way, start Marx's Capital, get a taste of it. I totally encourage that. I always encourage going to the direct texts of socialism and Marxism rather than the things written about socialism and Marxism by others. And what Marx wrote about, not in sort of the order you might want to read it, but I think it's chapter 10, if I'm not mistaken, in volume one of Capital. It's called The Secret of Primitive Accumulation, I think is how it's usually translated. And that's just about how feudalism, how capitalism came out of feudalism, basically. You know, very bloody, you know, to quote Marx, capitalism came out of feudalism dripping with mud and blood from every pore. The mud being theft of land, theft of common lands and so on from the peasants, but the blood being the bloody civil wars that the newly emerging capitalist class used to gain power in countries that were that had that level of economic advancement, quote unquote. So anyway, I'm reading Capital, and makes a lot of sense. Didn't really understand all of it, but I thought I did. That makes a lot of sense. I end up going to college in Boston, where there's left politics actually exists. So I start running into all these different left groups, checking them out and so on. So I don't want to give the full story of how I got involved with Socialist Alternative and so on, but just to say that it was all rather, you know, haphazard, and I had to take a lot of steps myself. The left at that time was not that welcoming a place, you know, given the Cold War pressures and the decline, because I came into politics after the upswing of radical politics in the 60s and 70s. I came in after that. I came in the 80s when things were going downhill. And in the eyes of many, for me, and others because we didn't see the new left, quote unquote, as a model, a good model, that we knew we had to start from scratch on the left, so to speak, in the United States in the 80s. That's when I ran into people from the Committee for Workers International, et cetera. Anyway, that's another story. The point is that without a workers' party of some sort, it's a miracle anyone becomes a socialist in this country, even nominally a socialist, even if they think they're a socialist and they're really not. It's still like, wow, how'd you manage that, you know? Because in countries where there's where there are mass workers' party, or a history of them at least, then you have this infrastructure. You have alternative media. You have, you know, all sorts of meeting public meeting places that, that are very hard to find here. You have political parties that you get involved with a campaign. You'll meet activists. Like a lot of different activists and different issues will merge together in a somewhat unified way in a party, in a campaign. Here it's all gets sucked into the Democratic Party, almost all, and that's a dead end. That's what kills the big social movements, and that's what continues to delay perpetually the formation of a Workers' Party. It's a vicious circle. So here's this positive view of socialism figure from the Gallup, and that's pretty interesting, because to get to there, it's a lot of work in the United States, you know, even without the Cold War propaganda now. So in 2016, we had 57% positive view of capitalism, but in 2018, this is among 18 to 29-year-olds, 45% positive view of capitalism with a 51% positive view of socialism. So it's fluctuated from 2010 to 2018 from about 49% to 55% in that range, 51% in 2018. Now, let's talk about other age groups, 30 to 49. 2018, 58% view, positive view of capitalism, 41% view, positive view of socialism. 2016, it was lower, but it was a bit higher. 2012, positive view of socialism, 2012. So 30 to 49, that's kind of depressing age group there. You know, they don't get it. But then 50 to 64, also not too high. Fluctuating a little bit lower than the 30 to 49-year-olds. 65 plus, lowest of all in terms of positive view of socialism. And not that much of a drop. I mean, not a horrible drop. You know, it's still 24 to 30% range. So you have a solid minority in each category of age, which, given the conditions again in the United States, that's pretty good. You know, not bad. So this made, like I said, this made some splash in the corporate media, usually around, hey, wait a minute, 51% of 18 to 29-year-olds have a positive view of socialism. Uh-oh. Or, and at the same time, on only a 45% positive view of capitalism. Now, this is somehow... like I read some headline would try to conflate those two figures and say 51% and 45% are equivalent. I don't see that. You know, you hear that thing about polling data being off by 3% or whatever. That's more than 3%. So check out that Gallup poll article, 8/13/2018, for more information on attitudes towards socialism. Now, behind this ideology or this idea of, I have an idea in my head about my attitude towards socialism, positive or not. Behind that, or informing that, or the context for that, is some very horrible things happening in U.S. society, some very difficult things that most working people are going through, and that's not reflected in the, you know, corporate media, obviously, but, you know, it's even not even what people talk about much, you know? But when, you know, a Democratic Party politician, when a few of them tack to the left recently and do a left populist thing, there's interest, you know? When somebody interviews somebody, they're more likely to, not more likely, I'm sorry, but they might say, I think more and more say, Despite the idea that the economy is a boom, in a boom period, that, wait a minute, it's not reflected in our wages. We're living paycheck to paycheck. We can't afford college. We don't know how we're going to afford college. I'm in the same boat. I've got kids who are my son approaching college age. Wow. I mean, how are we going to afford that? I mean, it's just impossible. Absolutely impossible. And I'm working extra hours, you know. My wife is working extra hours. We don't take vacations, you know, all that stuff, you know. And I'm not saying we've got the personal survival strategy that will allow you to survive capitalism. One thing could chuck us over the edge. One bad medical thing. Speaking of which, I hope this doesn't get worse. Could chuck us over the edge. You know, I really, really can't stand people that think they have the system figured out from an austerity point of view. Like, yes, I'm a victim, but I'm a happy wage slave because I make my lunch every day and save a few bucks doing that, you know, and, you know, I'll survive. Unfortunately, I've seen a lot of people not survive. Now, that doesn't mean they died suddenly. It just means that they never recovered, you know, from a hit. There's people in my union that I've always, you know, organized for. I helped organize the union where I work, along with a lot of other people, and was not pleased with how it became a very conservative union, a very pro-management union, not a union willing to organize the members, not a union leadership willing to struggle. But back when we used to have a semblance of meetings, they weren't real democratic meetings, but they were union meetings of a sort, where usually the leadership would just lecture us about how well they understood management and how stupid we were because we wanted too much. There'd always be this layer of workers. This is a tiny amount of workers. Most workers didn't go to these pseudo meetings. They didn't have a vote. Why go to a meeting? I can't vote on anything. They weren't democratic union meetings. They weren't normal union meetings. They were just sort of like, they call them union information meetings or something. And then it was the same old leaders who have outlived like the oldest Stalinist leaders that, you know, they're just in forever, it seems like. They will say, they'll explain why we must take like 1.5% raises every year, and that's in the years when we get them, you know, things like that. Or a little bit more than that, or a little bit less, depending on who you are. And it's really, really irritating, to say the least. But the point is that over the years, there's been people that want to play both sides of the fence. They want to be sympathetic to me and others that are trying to reform the union and make it strong, make it more democratic. And at the same time, they want to be in good with the union leadership. Because, you know, one thing about politics is it's not immune, left politics, whether it's union or socialist groups or whatever, not at all like immune from the crap you see in society, you know? I mean, we're dealing with, we're just organizing regular people, you know? And so people like to feel liked. People like to feel they're in the majority all the time, you know? It's really, really hard to find people with all the talk about democracy. I mean, Americans are quite conformist. I'm not blaming them. It's just the way we're taught. Really, really conformist. And we can appear to be idiosyncratic in some personal habits or something, or spout some sort of, you know, opinion that makes it seem like we're really not that conformist. But the vast majority of things that we do and say, you know, kind of fit within, you know, a real conformity engendered by the corporate media, engendered by educational systems and so on, you know. So you don't find much original thinking out there. Again, I'm not blaming people for that. That's just the way they don't want original thinking. You know, the corporate rulers, big business, they don't want people that can think for themselves. They want people that are, as George Carlin said, just smart enough to do the paperwork and all the heavy lifting, you know. But those of us that do kind of break out of that pattern for whatever reason, and we pay a price for it, believe me, but it's a good one. It's worth doing. And so you find yourself not just fighting management, but you have to fight the people that help management, the conservative union leaders in my case, or in this case I'm talking about, or other situations. And that can be very stressful. So some people, a lot of people just can't handle it. They're like, oh, you know, it could be worse. It could be worse. Yeah, you're right. We're not getting decent raises, but it could be worse. And it could be worse. And all the other forms of lesser evilism are kind of funny because it again, posits a world where things are predictably always going up in increments, you know, instead of a more volatile reality, more precarious reality, where things can be, you know, change, and you can, you know, say you have a, you don't have a pension anymore, you have a IRA or something linked to the stock market, man, that stuff can, and you don't want that, right, but you have to have it, that's all there is, that stuff can disappear, thousands and tens of thousands of dollars can disappear when the stock market drops out of your retirement, haha, and just so many other examples of precarious, you know, you get laid off, next job you get pays half of what you got before. But the point is that, you know, there's people that are, they want it easy, even though they know better, right? So they go along to get along. And I see these people where I work, and I see them then get laid off. And you know, where I work at Harvard University, there should be a no layoffs policy there because Harvard's big enough and rich enough. Well, I would say this at a corporation that claimed it wasn't rich enough, but Harvard's just an obvious example where you don't have to lay anybody off. You just you put them somewhere else, you know, retrain them. You know, it's very, very easy. And instead of doing that, they lay people off. They, of course, use that as a club and they to scare other people and so on. So I run into these people that defended the conservative union leadership, and, you know, You don't want to dump on somebody when they've been laid off and they can't get another job. They can't find a job. They trusted the unionship would find them a job back at Harvard. Never happened. They trusted the unionship would fight for them. Never happened. They trusted that they never would get laid off, that they believe the unionship. Well, we don't have that many layoffs. Well, you have a lot of layoffs, especially for a place that doesn't have to be any. And you just want to say, this is what I've been talking about for 10 years. When we were doing this stuff, when we were trying to reform the union, you know, I mean, you might really want to think about it, learn a lesson or two here, but you can't talk that way to people. It's just too cruel. So you hope they learn the lesson. You hint at it, sort of. You say, well, you know, we really should have a no layoffs clause like some unions have, and we could have that, you know. And anyway, that's just those kind of examples come up in politics in the United States all the time, in all sorts of circumstances, whether it's the lesser evilism in electoral politics, or whether it's the day-to-day union struggles for people that are in unions, or even workplace struggles where if you're not in a union, you're kind of in trouble, more trouble. But anyway, hey, by the way, we're not going to have time to get into this, but I just want to give a shout out to and a point out to, or whatever the word is. There's a strike happening right now in Oakland among the Oakland teachers. And it's a very conscious, like, political strike against, you know, the Board of Education wants to close 25% of the schools, privatize. They want to put more charter schools in. It's a very political strike against that and to get better conditions for the teachers. So go to socialistalternative.org. Check out more about the Oakland teacher strike. Google Oakland teacher strike, too. Very important struggle. Obviously, in the wake of the West Virginia teacher strikes that have happened. Notice I said plural, because the West Virginia teachers just went on strike again. And apparently, from what I've read, I have to double check this, they've won again. They beat back some legislation they didn't like. Overall, in the labor movement, a couple things have happened recently that you may have seen and yet might not have like hit your consciousness the way socialists would hope that it hits your consciousness. One is that you notice that government shutdown thing with Trumpo, that didn't really end until this leader of the flight attendants unions, what was her name? Sarah, I forgot her last name, Carlson or something like that. I have to look that up. She started making speeches and organizing the flight attendants, and talking to other unions. And suddenly the TSA workers are not showing up, some of them, and suddenly planes are not flying. And the minute there appeared to be even the hint of a general strike in the airline industry here in the U.S., or even a partial general strike, Trump backed down fast, really fast. And the Democrats also got scared, and they did that. They did that deal with Trump, which was a bad deal, by the way. So that was an example, that the glimpse, even in the United States, of where there's low union density now. But even in the United States, a glimpse of the power of working people. Potential power. And it's not just through unions, but that's one huge way working people can exercise political power and economic power. And the Bureau of Labor Statistics came out with statistics for 2018. There were more strikes in 2000, big strikes, because they have a baseline for strikes of, I think, 1,000 or more workers. More strikes in 2018 than at any time since 1986. That's a long time ago. And I was alive in 1986, and there was not yet, it wasn't yet completely understood that the labor movement was going to was going to go downhill faster than it already was. So 86 would have been a year of still a certain percentage of unions. I don't want to guess, but I mean, let's say 18% or something density versus the, 10% density now. I'd have to double check the figures. So anyway, very interesting that that happened. Interesting strike data and so on. Starting to run out of time. I'm going to have to hurry up. The re-election campaign for Shama Sawant, as we mentioned in the opening of the show, and again, Shama's name is spelled K-S-H-A-M-A, last name S-A-W-A-N-T. She's a sitting city councilor in Seattle. That's a lot of S's, okay. And she has run as an independent socialist, as a member of Socialist Alternative, not as a Democrat, ever. And she's running for re-election. And like I mentioned earlier, when she first ran and won in 2013, it made a huge splash where there were articles in the corporate media, New York Times, etc., but all over the world, actually. And basically, she was re-elected. Let me just read a quote here. I like the title a lot of this article. This article is from Socialist Alternatives newspaper, the current issue, I believe, February 2019, page 4, written by Shama herself. Hold on one second. Sorry about that. Quote, why we need socialists in public office now more than ever. Really like that title. And she had a press conference, made an announcement of her re-election campaign. So, quote, as we launched my socialist re-election campaign for Seattle City Council last week, we did so in a very different political context than when I was first elected as a socialist alternative candidate in 2013. Since then, U.S. politics have entered into a period of growing political and social upheaval in which interest in socialist ideas has rapidly developed. So I mentioned that Gallup poll earlier, for example. More registered voters now identify as independents than either Democrats or Republicans. This trend is even stronger among young people, with 71% of millennials saying they think the country needs a third major party, to represent the interests of ordinary people. While this dramatic growth in support for socialist policies might seem surprising to some, it is a natural response to the declining living standards facing working class Americans and the failure of capitalism to offer a future for young people. Nowhere in the country can a person working a full-time minimum wage job afford rent for a two-bedroom apartment. Nearly half of all Americans would struggle to pay an unexpected $500 medical bill. And today's college graduates will be paying off student loans well into their 40s. Combine this with the increasingly devastating forest fires and megastorms wreaking havoc as a result of climate change and the appalling rise of far-right hate groups, and it's not hard to see why ordinary Americans are desperate for meaningful change. So basically what I want to do is just point out, we can talk more in detail about at other shows and other shows about program and so on, what Shama's running on this time. I mean, originally the first election in 2013 was all about, there was a big program, but it became clear that $15 minimum wage was the most popular programmatic demand and the one that the most people identified Shama with. And after she got elected, she turned her whole campaign apparatus with the help of Social Alternative and others into a fight for 15 in Seattle, and it won. That's very good. She talks about the Amazon tax. I don't know if listeners have heard of that, but that was a huge thing in Seattle that at first, Shama leading the way got a tax on Amazon. All the Democratic Party council members, which is all of them except Shama, all of them except one plus Shama, came to the threats from Amazon to pull jobs and investment from the city, and they repealed the tax they had just unanimously passed. So that's going to be a big programmatic point, is the Amazon tax. I don't want to get too far into this right today without enough time. But as a socialist, this is a quote from the article, it's crucial to use the public profile of elected office to fight alongside workers and their unions. I've walked on the picket line with striking fast food workers, ATU transit workers, that's the American Transit Union, Teamster school bus drivers, and Seattle Education Association teachers. Shama herself was in that union, I believe, or in a similar teachers union, and used my office to advance their struggles in every way possible. I was proud to have John Frazier, president of WFSE, Local 3488 at Harborview Medical Center, stand with, hold on, let's see, I got to find another page here, stand with me at our launch event, where he said, quote, we need someone who's going to stand for working people, poor people, the voiceless. I've watched Shama stand with us every single time when there was injustice. We cannot let corporations silence voices like Shama. So, there's a lot of different things that her campaign is going to, a lot of different political positions her campaign is going to take. And the idea that Seattle is some progressive haven is addressed here. Not true, unfortunately. And she ends the article saying, in my 6 years in office, I've shown which side I'm on and how a fighting strategy can win historic gains. The fact that the political and business establishment will stop at nothing to unseat me proves the effectiveness of this approach. The impact of our movements has been felt nationally. This was shown when we made Seattle the first city to pass $15 minimum wage, $15 an hour minimum wage, and now the tax Amazon movement is spreading to California, New York City, and beyond. In the era of Trump, we urgently need more examples of how working class political leadership can work alongside social movements and prove where the real power in society lies, not in the back rooms of City Hall or the bank accounts of CEOs, but in the millions of ordinary people who do the work that make our society run. So I really like that. Thought I'd mention it on today's show. One thing to keep in mind is that, Amazon just got chased out of New York when they tried to set up in Queens. That's all very good, but if you could have your 5 minutes or your 30 seconds with Jeff Bezos, and asked him that's the head of Amazon, the richest person in the world. You asked him who he hated the most in the world. He'd probably name Shama Sawant. So there's going to be big corporate money, and there already is starting to appear, against Shama and having a socialist continue, meaning Shama, on Seattle City Council. Speaking of electoral politics, but going to a national viewpoint, I wanted also to point out an article that, again, Black Agenda Report. I never checked out how well-known Black Agenda Report is. I've known about them for years, and I met Glenn Ford, one of the editors, and talked to him. I wanted to have him on the show. He told me that Sundays were a day where he usually kicks back, and he's got to have a day off once a week because he's a very busy activist. And I said, I hear you. That was about it. Couldn't find a way around the Sunday thing. So this is from Black Agenda Report from February 13th. Actually, it's an article that they reran. It came from a newspaper called The Organizer, which I was familiar with back in the attempt to get a Labor Party going in the United States back in the 90s. Anyway, this is an interview with Nick Brana. Now, Nick Brana was a campaign manager for Sanders. And after 2016, he decided that he'd had it with the Democrats and that we need, working people, need a political party for working people, and that's not going to happen through the Democrats, obviously. So the title is The Left Finally Must Break with the Democrats, a discussion with Nick Brana from February 13th, 2019. It's vitally important to create a mass-based and corporate-free party of working people. And another quote, another poll quote here, the Democratic Party is so conservative that Pelosi is now left of center. I don't know if you saw that stuff. I mean, I probably have a very... I have a Facebook news feed that, you know, the way they've got the algorithms going kicks up a lot of similar stories. So I've been getting a lot about Pelosi and Feinstein mixing it up. I think it was Dianne Feinstein mixing it up with people, average voters, children, and so on. And they're just coming across as very arrogant, very right wing. Really out of touch with working people. And I would say that's true of the Democratic Party as a whole. So now this was a discussion with Nick Brana. He's executive director of the Movement for a People's Party and organizer for the Labor Community Campaign for an Independent Party. And again, 2019 Unity and Independence. Oh, it came from another publication. February 2019 issue of Unity and Independence, the monthly labor supplement of The Organizer newspaper. Nick Brana was an organizer for Draft Bernie for a People's Party back 2015 or whatever. Brana is now an organizer with the LCCIP. He no longer works with Sanders because Sanders is running as a Democrat again. The questions were posed by Alan Benjamin, member of the editorial board of The Organizer. Question: 3 months ago, the Democratic Party took back the House of Representatives. Now the media is full of stories about how the Democrats have shifted to the left, how progressives are poised to take back the party from the establishment Democrats, quote unquote. What's the reality there behind these stories? So Brana answers, and I'm not going to be able to read this whole article, obviously, but just bits and pieces of it really quickly. It's worth reading, and that's, I just really wanted to just like point it out, but I think I'm going to read a little bit of it. So the way to find it is go to, I'd say go to Black Agenda Report. You can find it through The Organizer also. Okay, so what does Brana say to that? Well, he says about the Democratic Party, shifting to the left, progressives are poised to take back the party. Oh, by the way, when did progressives ever have the party? Got to answer that one first, but whatever. So he goes back to 2016 election and says, as generations of progressives have done before them, supporters embarked on a renewed mission. Now, remember, generations of progressives have done before them, because they tried this again and again. Renewed mission to reform the Democratic Party after it rigged the presidential primary election. Their first thought was, what if we try to get a strong platform on the Democratic Party? Well, it turns out that the platform is non-binding and meaningless. That is why the party just scrapped the platform passed by the delegates the following year and replaced it with a more conservative one called the, quote, better deal, unquote. Well, next, progressives said, what if we try to elect a DNC chair to take over the party apparatus, end quote. It turns out again that the Democratic Party's members and voters have nothing to do with selecting the leadership of the party. The DNC members, corporate lobbyists, consultants, and superdelegates get to pick the Democratic National Committee chair. The party donors supported Tom Perez, so that's who we got. Once again, the progressives were thwarted by the party, the Democratic Party. So progressives then said, quote, how about if we replace the DNC members and get a majority, end quote. Well, at the DNC's fall meeting in 2017, the party simply picked out the progressives and purged them from the national committee. The shocked progressives then said, quote, what if we try to reform the presidential primary process ahead of 2020, end quote. So they pushed for the elimination of superdelegates, open primaries, same-day party registration, and progressive influence on the key rules committee, which oversees the primary process. And the DNC Unity Reform Commission was put together to level the playing field and to create a fair primary process. Now, then he goes in to explain how that was all undone by things like introducing a loyalty oath that allows the DNC chair to deny progressive access to the ballot. if he deems that the candidate has been insufficiently faithful, quote unquote, to the party during their life, and most important, it did nothing to remove corporate and billionaire money from the primary or the party, ensuring that Wall Street continued purchasing its politicians. I didn't have time to get into all the details. And then he talks about how the blue wave, remember that was the phrase they were using back in November of 2018 for the Democrats? The blue wave has actually been a corporate wave. When the dust settled November 2018, I'm quoting again, it turned out that the blue wave had been a corporate wave. The party establishment had succeeded. Successfully blocked all but two of the progressives who challenged incumbent Democrats. Only two progressives unseated House Democrats in all of 2018. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Ayanna Pressley. And again, as we said earlier in the show, that's pushing it with Ayanna Pressley. She really wasn't a progressive. Maybe she's changing. But in terms of being a real progressive, no. The other two progressives who often discuss the media, and the media basically swap seats with progressives who used to sit there. So Rashid Tlaib, sorry, I'm probably still mispronouncing that, took John Conyers' seat, and Ilhan Omar took Keith Ellison's seat. So with only two progressives in there, there was the call to replace Pelosi. Only the right wing of the Democrats, more right wing of the Democrats, really started up that. The majority of the Democratic House Caucus considers Pelosi to be out of step with the party because she's too far to the left, quote unquote. Democratic Party is so conservative that Pelosi is now left of center. That's where that quote came from. As a result, the progressives capitulated and voted to make Pelosi speaker again, but they went beyond endorsing her reluctantly. The handful of new progressives launched a campaign to rebrand her as a progressive. Pelosi comes from a space of activism and organizing, said Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. No one can really doubt Pelosi's progressive chops, stated Pramila Jayapal. Pelosi has a progressive track record, added Rashida Tlaib. Pelosi will play an important role in advancing the agenda of progressives, said Ilhan Omar. So this is a point where, I'm not quoting anymore, this is a point where, a point I often made, that when arguing with people about if you support a Democratic Party candidate, you support the Democratic Party. And how has that happened? Well, obviously they're in the Democratic Party, so they're encouraging people to identify with it, vote for Democratic Party candidates, not just themselves. They usually are encouraging people to vote for other Democratic Party candidates as well. You can see that here, where all these so-called progressives got in and then rallied behind Pelosi. They raise money for the Democratic Party. They take positions in the Democratic Party candidates. They vote, block vote with the Democrats, et cetera. So it's not as if you can maintain some sort of pristine environment on the edge of the Democratic Party once you enter that realm in an electoral sense and become a Democrat. Then they have a well-worn path for you to follow in terms of getting committee assignments, raising money, giving money to the party, voting. What to vote for, how to do lobbying, a whole apparatus of, campaign advisors and office workers and so on. It's not like you're this, like Ocasio-Cortez has this picture of being outside the party because she just doesn't look like a lot of the party, which is a good thing, but it's just still not real. It's not real in the sense of, she's going to be part of and is already showing herself to be part of the well-worn tracks of the, Democratic Party in terms of, defending, for example, let's put it this way. I was going to say defending capitalism, which is true. If you, again, there's that example of, can you be a capitalist and a democratic socialist? She said yes on TV recently, which is ridiculous. But I would say there's times where she might attack capitalism rhetorically, so that's why I hesitated. But mostly it's a reassurance that the two things are not, can live together, which they can't, really. They can't. Capitalism and socialism cannot live together. So it's a question of, if you believe in this dynamic, or this, not dynamic, I'm sorry, if you believe in this, the way this is set up, that these, anti-establishment or progressive Democrats can maintain a position of independence from the party they're in, then I think you're just living a fantasy, really. Now, this article gets very detailed. It's a very, very good article. Very much, very worth reading. Because it gets into the actual policies that the Democrats have put forward already, in the sense of just since November. One that we talked about on the show before is the PAYGO, P-A-Y-G-O, with a capital P, a capital G, PAYGO. That's short for, the Democrats had raised this before, as long ago as 2007. It came and went, and they brought it, and they resurrected again under Pelosi to say that they won't produce, they won't propose anything for a vote unless they have new funding for it, meaning an increase in spending must have an increase in revenue. Now, the way the Democrats and the Republicans always think about taxes is never a targeted tax on the rich and the super rich and the big corporations. Sometimes they can be forced into doing that, but it's not their default position. Their default position is taxes in general. You know, taxes that will hit a wide section of the working class to pay for something and not just be directed at the people that can afford to pay the taxes. Anyway, I will have to finish this article because it's really worth going into in detail next time, because we're running out of time. I also want to turn people on to, which we'll get into next time, a couple other things really quick. If you want to see someone like Sanders in terms of, reputation, or even more so than Sanders, popularity, even more so than Sanders, who decided to use the Democratic Party ballot line, as they say, try to make it sound nice, in DSA and so on, for Sanders to use the Democratic Party ballot line. We have the example, and this goes from Upton Sinclair. So Upton Sinclair was a member of the Socialist Party for a long time. He was well known as the writer of The Jungle, and he, actually a lifelong member of the Socialist Party, but he changed his party registration to the Democratic Party to run for governor of California in 1934, in the midst of the Great Depression. And despite the successful strikes in 1934 and so on, using the Democratic Party did not help him, and he lost the election, actually. And this is really, really worth getting into. Now, the thing with Sanders is that he's never even had that experience of being in a socialist party or social democratic party before taking that leap into the Democratic Party. He was up in Vermont. He did spend early in his career some time trying to do third party politics from a progressive standpoint, and quickly abandoned it, or relatively quickly abandoned it, unfortunately. And then it was never part of even a social democratic party. You know, he ran as an independent up in Vermont. I think that matters. I think it matters whether you have some sort of party loyalty, basically. Now, right now, he's got party loyalty with the Democrats. That's proven through his committee assignments and through fundraising he's done for them. And that makes him not a socialist, among other things, by the way. Also, didn't have time for this. Really interesting article, Reading Paine from the Left, P-A-I-N-E, Tom Paine, not Paine, but Thomas Paine, the figure of the American Revolution. Thomas Paine was the American Revolution's most radical figure. It's an article by Sean Monahan from Jacobin Magazine back in 2015, but I just stumbled across it lately. And apparently he says that the people like Glenn Beck and these right-wing radio people, they try to use Paine as an example of something or other. I don't know what, nationalism or something. And in reality, Paine was very radical for his time. A lot of ideas that later became more fleshed out socialist ideas were kicking around, and Paine embraced a lot of those. So I want to get into that also next time. Right now, we're going to start to wrap up the show with some music. And again, sorry if you had to live through a little bit of coughing on my part. Next time we'll be in full health, I hope. Next time we'll get into this book I highly recommend. We mentioned it on the air before. It's by Michael Yates, Yates is well known as an editor of Monthly Review Press. He was a professor for a long time, then literally hit the road and was living, him and his wife just were living all around the country working and stuff. That's not the point. The biography is not important. He just wrote a book recently. Let me just check the... he wrote a book called Why Unions Matter a few years ago that was quite good. This is 2018. Can the Working Class Change the World? And there's some good stuff in this, really good. I don't agree with everything in it, but I wanted to get into it a little more. And let me just jump in for one little thing. He takes the time to link the ideas in here about activism and so on to Marxism. He is a Marxist. So he says, so he's in the second chapter, he's getting into, quote unquote, some theoretical considerations. What is capitalism? And since we're always defining capitalism in like sound bites on the show, and what is socialism, I thought I'd get into this a little bit, more so next time. Quote, what is capitalism? Again, this is Michael Yates. Capitalism is a social system built upon exploitation and expropriation. It is both an economy and a society composed of multiple connected elements. First, its central economic feature is production for the market as opposed to production for use. It does not matter that people might need a product. If there is no market for it, it will not be produced. Putting this matter concretely, it means that if those who control production are motivated by profits, if they do not expect to make money, they will not send goods and services to market. Second, the non-human means of production, land, machinery, tools, equipment, buildings, raw materials, and the like, are the private property of capitalists who always comprise a small fraction of the population. Today, capital is organized in large global corporations, each controlling enormous amounts of productive property and cash resources. Third, most people must sell their labor power, their capacity to work, to the owners of the means of production. Therefore, capitalist economies have labor markets in which labor power is bought and sold. Those who sell this are free, but in a double sense. They are not bound personally to a superior, as were feudal serfs and slaves. However, they are also free, quote-unquote, of any significant means of production, like land, for example, and are therefore compelled to find a buyer for their ability to work. They are not compelled to labor for a particular employer, but they must toil for some person, company, or entity. Failure to do so can have disastrous results, including death. Note that historically, as discussed in Chapter 3, unfree labor, mostly slave, was critical to the birth and advance of capitalism. Unfortunately, slave labor is still utilized by capital. These economic characteristics of capitalism can be easily shown. The corporate pursuit of profits is too well known to require proof. Suffice it to mention that the Ford Motor Company knew that its Pinto model's fuel system would be prone to rupture if the car was struck from behind, possibly causing riders to burn to death. Yet its accounts estimated it would be cheaper to let people die and perhaps pay a cash settlement than to re-engineer the car. So then he goes on with more examples. For example, he goes, one startling statistic says it all. The three wealthiest people in the United States, Bill Gates, now it's Jeff Bezos, now it's been switched, it's Bezos and Gates, and Warren Buffett, now own more wealth than the entire bottom half of the American population, a total of 160 million people, or 63 million households. So anyway, we'll get into that more next time as well. So thank you very much for listening in. Go to Socialist Alternative Radio on Facebook. We post and share a lot of stuff on there that you'll like. And we're live on air every other week, Sundays, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Go to WMFO.org to listen via your computer. And we are part of Tufts Educational Radio, Tufts Community-Based Radio, all that good stuff, emanating from 91.5 FM, that's WMFO in Medford, and also known as WMFO Medford or WMFO in Medford. And you can listen anytime by going to WMFO.org, click on schedule, click on the show you want to listen to, maybe it's Socialist Alternative Radio, we hope, and give us a listen. And we do have some listeners from around the country and around the world. Thank you for writing into us. We'll keep plugging away despite the little setback here of getting sick. And also, the you know, like we said earlier in the show, check out what's happening in Oakland with the Oakland teachers strike. And, you know, really try to, I would suggest, just humbly, go beyond the way the corporate media is trying to water down and weaken what the word socialism means, and rediscover, by whatever means, by actions, by words, that it means the transformation of society from capitalism, the pursuit of profit at all costs, to socialism, the pursuit of human, of fulfilling human needs in a democratic, sustainable way. Again, thanks for listening to our show. We'll be back in a couple weeks.
Of London town, where there's forces raised and barricades. Believe me, man, I'm down. Tyrants, bloodsuckers, and bagmen got us picking through the crumbs. Raise your voices all together, motherfucker, here we come.
Worldwide rebel songs, sing out loud all night long. Hang on, man, it won't be long.
Slums in Korea, open fire with a guitar, bass, and drums. Down in Gaza, down in Fresno, out your door and down your street. Are you gonna stand around, or are you gonna be free?
Worldwide rebel songs, sing out loud all station, and it's pulling in today. We won't be coming home tonight, love. The fight has just begun. Raise your voices all together, motherfucker.
Sky.